Before I begin the readings this morning, when Diane was talking about world wars and that sort of thing with the children, I was looking at the flowers here, red and white, and a lot of English people in particular look at red and white flowers as being blood and bandages. So I thought I'd mention that to you. This morning, our two readings, first of all, Ruth, chapter 3, verses 1 to 5, and then 13 to 17. Ruth and Boaz at the threshing floor. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, I need to seek some security for you, so that it may be well with you. Now here is your kinsman, Boaz, with whose young women you have been working. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now wash and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he is finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." She said to her, "All that you tell me, I will do." And when Boaz discovered her, he spoke kindly with her. "Remain this night, and in the morning, if he will act as next of kin for you, good, let him do it. If he is not willing to act as next of kin for you, then, as the Lord lives, I will act as next of kin for you. Lie down until the morning." So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before one person could recognize another, for he said, "It must not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." Then he said, "Bring the cloak you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her back. Then he went into the city. She came to her mother-in-law, who said, "How did things go with you, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "He gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said, 'Do not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" The gospel reading this morning comes from Mark chapter 12, verse 38 to 44. Jesus denounces the scribes.
"I know what the problem is, John."
"Yes.
We have a little problem trying to work out how this Bible reading came together to make sense."
"Yes.
We need to read verses 13 to 17 from chapter 4.
Ah.
Let's see if that makes... that will get us a bit further in the story.
We tried to fix this up before the service. Yeah. What was it? So I'll go again from verse 13. "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When they came together, the Lord made her conceive, and she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned on Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has borne him.' Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. The women of the neighbourhood gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi.' They named him Obed. He became the father of Jesse, the father of David." That makes more sense. And now we'll go to our gospel reading, Mark chapter 12, verses 38 to 44. Jesus denounces the scribes. "As he taught, he said, 'Beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to have the best seats at the synagogues and places of honour at the banquets. They devour widows' houses and for the sake of appearance say long prayers. They will receive the greatest condemnation.' He sat down opposite the treasury and watched the crowd putting money into the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came and put in 2 small copper coins, which are worth a penny. Then he called his disciples and said to them, "Truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury. For all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has been everything she had, all she had to live on." The wisdom of God. God's word made new.
Who here has ever heard a joke about mothers-in-law? I think there's some fibbers out there. And who here is a mother-in-law? I think mothers-in-law get a bum rap. I think they're an easy target for a certain type of comic, and I believe they're unfairly derided for the sake of a cheap laugh. And I say that not only as a mother-in-law myself, but as someone whose own mother-in-law is one of my most favourite people. Along with my own mother, Nancy, or Nana, or as I usually refer to her, Kim's mum, has supported me, cared for me, given me opportunities for rest when my children were small. Kim's mum and mine saved my sanity. They encouraged me. They made my life easier and more joyful. And I'm eternally grateful to both of them. I think of the holidays that we used to have when we used to go up to Port Augusta. And Kim's mum and dad have a fairly small 3-bedroom house, and we used to go up with 4 kids, and there was always room for us, and there was always meals cooked for us, and there was always help with the washing. And it was a great blessing to me and to Kim. But above all, my mother-in-law, or Kim's mum, has my gratitude for being just that. Kim's mum. And that's why I'm happy to refer to her that way. I think of it as a role of honour, being Kim's mum. She's the person who raised and nurtured the man I married. And for that alone, I will be grateful to her. And apart from that, as I've already said, she's just a lovely woman. I was, of course, reminded of my mother-in-law and her generous love as I started preparing for this week. As the Old Testament reading begins, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, and there unfolds advice born out of concern and love. Last week, David introduced us to the story of Naomi and Ruth and connected the birth of Obed, Ruth's son, to Boaz, to the birth and life of Jesus. The reading last week included what is probably the most well-known words from Ruth, and which we echoed in our call to worship this morning. They are words that you may have heard used at weddings. In fact, did you read these words at Kate's wedding, or was it somebody else? Yeah, do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. Yet, while the story of Ruth does include a wedding, those words are not words of love whispered between husband and wife, but the words of one young widow to an older one, the words of a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law. And they are no less words of love and devotion for that. The story of Ruth is a love story on many levels, and it is a story that reminds us what it means to be God's people and how we faithfully live that out. Now, while this story is set early in the history of Israel, before the tribes were united under the first king, biblical studies would tell us that it would have taken its final form, its final written form, many, many years later, after the monarchy was established, after King David, after too many unfaithful kings, after the exile to Babylon and return. It seems to have been written shortly after the time that the books of Ezra and Nehemiah were written. Now, we don't often, I don't know if we ever, really get to hear from Ezra and Nehemiah. So let me give you some of the flavour of what Ezra and Nehemiah say in the context of what Ruth is saying. The return of the exiles from Babylon in joy and the laying of the foundations of the new temple are reported. The people sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to God, for God is good. God's steadfast love endures forever to Israel. And the worship life, the festivals and the sacrifices resume. But all does not go right and the religious leaders know who to blame. The foreigners. When Ezra hears from some of his local officials that the people of Israel, the priests and the Levites, have not separated themselves from the people of the land with their abominations, from the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians and the Amorites, for they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons. When he hears that, Ezra tears his clothes and pulls his hair. And it says, he sat appalled until the evening sacrifice. He's only able to feel more positive when one of the local men promises to make a covenant with our God to send away all those wives and their children. A little later, Governor Nehemiah, reacting to those Jews who had married foreign women, including women from Moab, recalls that, I contended with them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. And I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, you shall not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. The story of Ruth stands against these attitudes. It's not that there's any signs of deeper conflict or hotly contested debates or political manoeuvring in the book of Ruth. And while there is the misery of people fleeing famine and the sadness of death and even the suspense of how Ruth and Naomi will survive, it can seem like a sweet romance with a happy ending or a nice folk tale that tells us the origin of King David. But as we hear the voices of Ezra and Nehemiah, we can begin to sense within Ruth a real difference of opinions being put forward. An ideological, political, theological debate on what it means to be God's faithful people, on who is included in God's loving kindness. Israel's early laws were inclusive. After all, early on, Israel was at first a collection of tribes, some who claimed their descent from Jacob via Egypt, and others who had different histories, different ancestry. The different tribal identities were merged into one larger nation, a multicultural nation that was necessarily very inclusive. Those laws state that non-Israelites who seek to become part of Israel are to be treated fairly, with rights almost exactly the same as those who are already there. And the same laws require that the poor, the widows and the orphans are to be taken care of. And they also require Israel to look after the welfare of the aliens or the stranger. And Ruth, of course, is all of the above. She's poor, she's a widow, and she's a foreigner. This is what's happening when she's allowed to glean, to pick up the grain that's left after the harvester's work. The law states that that's to be left for those without land. However, by the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, Israel is feeling much more vulnerable. An often persecuted minority in a strategic location and a hostile political landscape. And like many others in such situations, when you feel your own survival threatened, sometimes it seems that being absolutely clear about who is and who isn't part of your group is an essential part of that survival. Of keeping your community and nation pure and true to your traditions and history. And as you narrow your group boundaries, the tendency can be to narrow your understanding of God and where God's love and concern extends. You may recognise some of the Ezra-Nehemiah approach in our political discourse, in claims of who's taking away whose jobs. in fabricated claims of refugee entitlements. I've received numerous emails telling me how much money that refugees will get. All of it complete rubbish. We hear it in talk of Australian values, as if other countries don't also value caring for one another. We hear it in the talk of the possibility of other cultures overwhelming ours. And then it seems, in the name of Australian values, we need to renounce, just for a while, those Australian values we espouse and certain aspects of our culture in order it's claimed to defend them. Well, one of the best ways to counter such opinions, to put the case for being more welcoming and compassionate towards refugees and other migrants, is not just in debate. It is in letting those stories be heard. And not just the stories of hardship that drive them to Australia, but also their stories of how, the stories of how they have contributed to this country. How their very presence has indeed strengthened the values and the culture that they are accused of threatening. The writer of the Book of the Ruth also believes that the best way to counter the voices of those who come down on the side of exclusiveness is not by forceful argument or clever rhetoric, but in the type of story that seems harmless, but leaves the sense of a different truth in the minds of those who hear and listen and absorb. It's not just that Ruth is a foreign woman who becomes part of King David's family tree. She is a woman who is declared to be worth more than seven Jewish sons. In those days when women had very low status, she is declared to be worth more than seven sons. And not just because she's born a son. No, it's because she has been a model of faithfulness, a woman who lives in her own life much of what is claimed for God, that deep loving kindness that God shows to God's people that goes beyond what is deserved or earned or required. And Boaz, who recognises Ruth's own faithfulness and rewards that loving kindness with his own, goes beyond what is required by the law. When Boaz first sees Ruth gleaning in his fields, he recognises her as the one who has shown exceptional loving kindness by her mother-in-law and responds by allowing her not only to pick up the drop grain, which is what the law requires, but arranging her for her to be given more. And in agreeing to marry Ruth, Boaz moves beyond what the law requires into God's welcoming generosity. Even Naomi, who is at one time so bitter and beaten down, moves beyond her own concerns to consider and ensure her daughter-in-law's future. Not all of what Naomi plans and Ruth enacts would be considered to be within the bounds of lawful or proper behaviour. But Ruth and Naomi seem less concerned with what is strictly lawful and proper, and more concerned with what is loving. It is from this community of people, people who have experienced and practiced commitment and generosity and loving kindness, that Israel's future is said to emerge. This is how Israel ensures its purity and its identity as God's people. Not by strict adherence to racial boundaries, but by being committed to the same loving kindness that they know in God. In the Gospel, we have another story about another widow, where we are reminded of this. Jesus contrasts the correct according to the law giving of the rich and the strict law abiding of the scribes with that of the widow whose whole life is offered, who gives deeply and completely. The posturing, parading men are upstaged by a poor, pathetic woman. Jesus notices her. He sees her. He connects with her and comments on her participation in a society and religious system that seems to have turned its back on her needs and turned their eyes from the vision of community that God gives to God's people. I'm sure we have all heard the story of the widow and her mite often as an example of the commitment we should follow. And there may be some of that commendation in what we hear Jesus say. But there is also condemnation. Condemnation of a religious system that rather than supporting those in need, like the widow, actually requires her to give all she has. The temple should be giving money to her to support her, not demanding it, the last she has, from her. God's vision and gift of community has been turned upside down. In the name of maintaining a religious system that is supposed to help God's people live out their purpose, to love God and love neighbour and to care for the poor and needy, that very religious system betrays that purpose. Real giving, real commitment, Jesus states, is never a surface matter, never something that can be prescribed by law. Real commitment is something that involves the whole of our lives. All our heart, all our soul, all our mind and all our strength. Real giving, real living requires us to live out the value of God's vision that is about including all people in community, even where that costs us. And as we have our attention drawn to that poor widow, as we watch what she does, we realise that we are in the presence of another who has given all he has, that we might become part of the community of God's people, the community who practice welcome, generosity, inclusiveness, the community formed by loving kindness. And perhaps when we feel tempted to betray our values, it might pay us to think about what we feel is threatening us and our way of life. Because perhaps it isn't a threat to our way of life after all, but an opportunity. An opportunity to enter more deeply into that way of life. An opportunity to serve, to love, and be the community God calls us to be. The story of Ruth is a romance, and it is a political statement. But above all, it is a love story. It is a love story in the traditional sense of man and woman meeting, getting married, having a child. It is a love story of mother-in-law for daughter-in-law and vice versa. And it is most of all a story of God's love seen in the story of God's loving community. Loving kindness seen often in costly acts that come from deep within who we are. That is where the future of God's people lie.